Well, we're coming to the end of a number of things, and just like usual, nobody seems to know exactly where we're going. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
As always, Barry, it's great to be back with you. I'm very happy to be here in the studio. I wish it would warm up. This is we're recording this on Thursday, April 23rd, 2020. And I want it to warm up. I have a project I'm working on, and I want to finish it.
I get that. It's, you know, but weather's being as it is, you know, we are still in April, and I know in our area we're talking about, we just had like some cold front come through. It's supposed to be a lot of wind today, soaking rains now through the weekend. Just lovely April weather.
Yeah. Yeah. April showers bring May flowers, unless you live in Michigan, in which case the end of May showers bring July flowers. And then the first frost. I was just joking with a friend of mine. A lot of people don't know, I graduated from Michigan State University, and I lived in Michigan for 11 years. Did work up there. So we always do the jokes about, you know, bombardier mosquitoes. And you go out in the early evening, and it sounds like the buzzing of the wings sounds like a squadron of B-17s going over. If you've ever heard a B-17 fly, you'll understand that. But, yeah, I'm done with it. We had spring in March, and now we're having late winter in April. So,
something of that. Well, you know, everything is kind of topsy-turvy right now, Chuck. I mean, hey, we're having a March primary election that's finishing at the end of April.
And just since you bring that up, it's not really a primary election. It's not.
Well, it technically is supposed to be.
Let's yes, it is has been deemed to be a primary, but it's not because nobody was allowed to go out and vote. You had to jump through a bunch of flaming buffalo dung hoops to be able to get a ballot and turn it in. And then, thanks to your son, we discovered another problem.
Well, yeah, okay. So
potential here, problem.
We'll go into that here in a little bit of detail. Okay, as I think most of our listeners are aware, the original primary election for 2020, where we go to the polls to choose the individuals who will be the standard bearers for the fall election of 2020 on the ballot. You know, you had things like the presidency is up this year. Pretty much every congressperson is up. In Ohio this year, we don't have any of our U.S. Senate candidates up because this is our off cycle 2 years. And then 2 years from now in 2022, there'll be another round. I think Rob Portman's seat comes up in 2 years and then Sherrod Brown's comes up again. So we don't have that, but we do have all of our state representatives at the state level and half of the state Senate seats, and I don't believe in your area, Chuck, you had a state Senate race.
No, we did not.
I don't necessarily have one, at least for another 2 years here in my district, because my senator is in their last term. The Senate gets two consecutive four-year terms that they can run, before they're termed out of office under Ohio's current term limits. And we'll talk a little bit. Remind me to come back around to the term limit thing, too, because there's an effort underway that is questionable right now how soon it's going to be underway with everything that's
been delayed. What's going on, yeah.
But again, so you're getting your ballots. And oftentimes you're going to have your county folks. I think, you know, we've got like two county commissioner seats and all the county office holder seats are up this year. And folks are going to have these various things. Well, that primary election was supposed to be held on March the 17th, which, you know, again, is a weird date to start with, Chuck. Now,
yeah,
I find
odd.
This very interesting. I thought about this too, Charles. And that is, in a non-presidential election cycle, which means, you know, so every 4 years we have to elect or re-elect a president of the United States, the primary is usually on the first Tuesday in March, or excuse me, in May. But because Ohio wanted to run and become like one of the early decider states for the a nominee to be able to lock up all the votes they needed in order to take a nomination for their party's presidential nomination. They pushed forward and said during on a presidential cycle, which this year happens to be one again, that the primary had to be the first Tuesday in March. Well, why did I... March the 17th is not the first Tuesday in March.
No, sir.
That was because the party apparatus of both the Republicans and the Democrat parties kind of got tired, and it was becoming problematic from technical and other standpoints for everybody to run, and every state was trying to leapfrog the other ones and get earlier and earlier, and what they were worried about was they were going to start having primaries in December of the year before.
Yeah, I mean, it's a natural progression. I mean, really is.
Yeah, it is. So the parties threw in a thing and basically said, okay, we're going to freeze this. And the states that were traditionally a Super Tuesday state, you know, which is that first Tuesday in March, that had historically been a Super Tuesday state, would stay there. And that any other states that tried to leapfrog or tried to shoehorn in on that Super Tuesday, or get earlier than Super Tuesday, would end up being penalized by losing delegates to the convention, which is basically the reason why they were leapfrogging, was so that their delegates would be the ones who got the nominee over the hump. Well, kind of, you know, defeats their purpose of moving earlier if they lose a percentage or many of their delegates. And, you know, yeah, we got an early primary, but the nominee's only going to get 20% of our delegates because we violated party rules. So that kind of froze everything out, but Ohio had already by statute moved our elections from May in the presidential year to March. So here, just a couple years ago, they decided to move this one back a little bit because, again, it was another party issue where they were kind of like, yeah, this things are bunching up, we could have this spread out. So Ohio backed off till March the 17th, the third Tuesday in March for this cycle, which just so happened to coincide and falling on St. Patrick's Day.
Yes.
Well, okay, so all great, right? Well, you know, nobody expected, just like nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, Chuck, nobody expected the novel coronavirus COVID-19 to show up on our shores and create the chaos that it has created, or the chaos that has been created by officials and political types responding to the appearance of COVID-19 on our shores, responding utilizing horribly outdated and overestimated data sets and models. But we've talked about that before on the program. So what we had was on Monday, on the 16th of March, you know, as the governor had been issuing the social distancing imperatives and other things, and they were starting to close things down, Monday morning they came out and said, hey, all good, primary's going to go on. You know, it was the governor, the Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, and Dr. Acton, Amy Acton, the director of the Department of Health, who were all standing there saying, hey, everything's great, everything's fine. A little bit later in the afternoon, they come out, well, you know, we know that, you know, there's a lawsuit that's been filed and trying to prevent the primaries from going forward, you know, because of the dangers to senior citizens, especially those who are poll workers, because I don't know about you, Chuck, but in my polling places, the average age of a poll worker, especially during a primary election, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 70.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to be sarcastic and say about 108, but yeah.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, I said average age, so the mean median or the mode. Yeah, one of the things. No, you're
right.
One of those is 70,
you're right. It's older people, and the reason is they're retired for the most part, and they can volunteer and volunteer all day.
Right. They have the time to sit there, yeah, and go in at like 4 o'clock in the morning and pick up the ballot boxes and all that fun stuff, and the chief deputy goes and unlocks the polling place and sets up, make sure the machines are set up correctly and everything's working okay. And yeah, most of those people will stay there all day. They'll be, you know, it's a 13-hour, we go from 6:30 in the morning till 7:30 in the evening for an open poll. So a 13 hours of open polls, and a lot of these people stay there all day. They stay there the whole 13 hours plus because they're there beforehand in order to set up, and then they're afterwards in order to collect and make sure everything's tallied, you know, and submit it to the county board of elections so that it can be tallied correctly. So it's a big, long day. I get it. But so they, you know, the governor signals that, you know, that they're not sure because they've been sued. Well, what he wasn't saying, which we found out later, was it wasn't that all of a sudden somebody cropped up with a lawsuit. It was that his administration, probably him directly and the Secretary of State, went out to a former director of the Department of Aging, Judith Brockman, and others with the Ohio Jewish Federation and, of course, the Ohio League of Women Voters, and got them to file a lawsuit against the state. And then directed the Attorney General, who is the state's attorney when the state is sued, not to fight the lawsuit. Because they wanted to have a reason to shut things down.
Right.
Well, funny thing happened on the way to the forum. They ended up pulling a judge in Franklin County who took a look at the lawsuit, took a look at the law surrounding it, and took a look at the Ohio Constitution. Chuck, got to give this judge credit for actually looking at the Ohio Constitution.
Exactly.
Because what he found was that only the General Assembly of the state of Ohio has the authority, and it's solely vested in the General Assembly, to change or to set a date of an election. So he said, sorry, I can't give you what you want because you don't have the jurisdiction or the authority to do that or to change the election date. Now, the problem is that, you know, as they were coming out and saying that they figured this was going to happen, you know, they're pitching out there of, oh, well, we can just go to the first two. We'll have the primary in June. That was what the Secretary of State said. Well, Secretary of State should have read the Constitution. He doesn't have the authority to set a date. That's the General Assembly. The governor doesn't have the authority to set or to change a date of an election. That's the General Assembly. Chuck, had the General Assembly, did they come in that Monday and say, okay, well, we're going to change the date?
They sure didn't. They weren't consulted at all.
They sure did not. That's right. But what they did do is they had to come in after the fact because the governor got the director of the Department of Health, Amy Acton, to issue a health order basically prohibiting the polling places from being opened on Tuesday. All of the polling places, Chuck, statewide. Nobody could open up. So if you don't have an open polling place, how do you cast a vote? Well, you don't.
Yeah,
you have
exactly.
to cast a vote. You have to cast a vote. If you hadn't already applied for and gotten an absentee ballot and cast that for that election, which by Monday night when this was all going down, and it was overnight, it was like after midnight, when the Ohio Supreme Court weighed in and basically gave them what they wanted. As the excuse to be able to not have the election on Tuesday, but the whole point was that the legislature hadn't done anything, and it was too late for people to cast an absentee ballot. So that happened, like I said, March 16th and 17th. Well, the next week, because now we're in chaos, Chuck. An election hasn't occurred. Technically, now they do have ballots that have been cast because of absentees that were filed already, but we don't have any finality to an election. There's no votes. There are very few votes. The absentees can be counted, but they are only counted after the count is done on the day of the election. We just didn't have it. Well, the election day was here by law, by the Constitution, by the General Assembly. March the 17th was the election day, but nobody could vote because we were all barred from the polling places. The polling places were barred from opening because of the excuse of COVID-19. Well, that created a constitutional crisis, and the legislature was getting ready to come in and meet until the governor reminds the legislature that, hey, I issued an order that you can't have any more than 10 people in a group getting together. And, well, Chuck, I don't know. Go back and help our folks with civics. The Ohio General Assembly is made up of the Senate and the House of Representatives. The Senate has 33 members. The House of Representatives has 99 members. That's a bit more than 10, wouldn't you say?
I would say so.
I would say that that's a bit more than 10. So they had to figure out a way. And first thing was that the Speaker of the House was basically saying, I don't really think the governor has the authority to tell the General Assembly how we manage our affairs, because that's another area that is given solely to the, you know, the operation of that chain of the legislature. Their rules and their procedures are set by them, not by a governor, not by the secretary, and certainly not by the director of the Department of Health issuing an order. But in order to, you know, not have a bad day in the press, they figured out a way around it where they basically called everybody back in for a vote the following week, Chuck, this was the week later, and they split them up and they opened up committee rooms, and they'd have four or five members sitting in a committee room, of course, with 6-foot distances between them, Chuck, because we want to maintain that social distancing. Where they had their laptops and they had audio, where, you know, and so they had some people on the floor, and it was mainly the ones on the floor were mainly leadership members. But they were all spread out around the chamber. There weren't much in the way of staff that was allowed in, but the media, you know, could feed in. So, you know, this whole thing about social distancing being what it is, you know, it doesn't apply to folks who, you know, are they considered essential governmental workers like, you know, media reps and reporters. Honestly, I find that kind of fascinating, but we'll talk about it some other time. So the legislature comes in, they pass an emergency measure, and their emergency measure didn't rein in the director of the Department of Health. It didn't put parameters around her health emergency powers. It didn't say that the orders that she had put forward were invalid or illegitimate, were unconstitutional, but they were. No, what they did was they said, well, you know, we'll work it out here, and we're going to have the close-off date be April 28th on this primary election so that we can get it done, but it can only be by absentee mail-in ballots because, well, you know, COVID and shutting down all these things, we can't, you know, allow people to have access and open it up. So here we are right now, Chuck. Long story coming around that if you want to vote in the primary election of 2020, you have to apply for to the county, your county board of elections, an absentee ballot. And you've done that. I've done that. My family has done that. We received our ballots. It's a packet. You actually have the ballot where, you know, you would, and it's the paper ballot where you fill in the little circles or next to the names of people that you are picking to vote for. And then that form is then folded up and put into an envelope, which is an envelope that has some things on it that have to be filled out. It's a form from the Ohio Secretary of State's office. This envelope is actually a form. It's got a sticker on it with your name and your information from where you applied to get your absentee ballot. But you basically have to fill in almost the exact same information on this envelope. That envelope sealed with your ballot inside of it, and then it goes inside of another envelope, which is sealed and mailed back with postage already prepaid. I'm going to give them that. Our tax money for that. Postage already prepaid to go back to the County Board of Elections so that that ballot can be cast and counted. Well, as you mentioned way earlier when we started this whole thing, my son, my 18-year-old son, who is voting for the first time, Chuck, in an election, a presidential primary, have you. So I'm pretty proud of that. He comes to me after he's gotten his ballot and he's gone through it and he's coming back and he's like, Dad, I got a question. I'm like, what? He's like, what should I put down here on this envelope? There are five slots, you know, five places, and they ask you the thing like your birth date and, you know, your ID, things of that nature. But then it says election. And then it says date of election was the first question. What should I put down for the date of the election?
Yeah.
That's what I hadn't pulled mine. I had my ballot sitting out on my desk, but I hadn't gotten around to it. I was doing a couple other things. And I just stopped and looked at him. I said, that's a mighty fine question, son, because, you know, that's very interesting. Because the actual date of the election that you're casting a ballot for is March the 17th. However, it's now April the 20th. So the question is, would that ballot count if you, because by law, absentee ballots for the election of March the 17th were to be cast and resubmitted by the election day, postmarked by the election day, to the County Board of Elections. So they'd have to have a postmark of March 17th. Problem is, it's April the 20th. And yes, the legislature moved everything and said, but there was nothing, because there was a sheet of instructions from the Ohio Secretary of State's office, and it did have dates on it. They talked about April 27th and April 28th, about, you know, mailing it in or having it postmarked by the 27th,
yeah.
or walking it in by the 28th, to your County Board of Elections, which, if I think, Chuck, most of them still aren't open. Because I don't believe there was any relief from the non-essential business thing for the county boards of elections to stay open. Most government employees had been furloughed or sent home, or they're working from home. Then raises the question: is how do you go if you have to cast your ballot and you have to take it in physically? Where do you take it to, and can you get it filed? So that's another question. But going back to that main question: date of election. That's a big problem. If you put March the 17th down and it's your ballot is postmarked in April, or is it going to be invalidated? Probably not. We would hope, common sense would prevail and they would say, no, we know this is special circumstances. But what if you date your ballot envelope April 28th, which is the day that the legislature set for finishing out the primary election for everything to come in?
Well, look, all it's going to take is one deeply partisan director of elections in one county, and the whole thing's a mess.
Well, yeah, and frankly, we'll probably have that. One way or the other, those things will probably happen in some county where some of these ballots will be set aside, marked as provisional, because there's a discrepancy on what date they put on this official governmental form. And Chuck, as this came and we found this out this night, I called you up and you and I had a little chat about it.
Yeah, we did.
You hadn't cast your ballot yet either. And I had told you I had done something. What I had done is that I'm on a platform called LinkedIn, which is a business networking platform. I have an account there, and one of the people who is on my account list as my LinkedIn too is Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Well, I reached out to Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Remember, this is now like 9 o'clock at night. So because most of the, if you try to call a state government agency right now, you get a voicemail, because most of their staff are furloughed or working from home, and that includes the Secretary of State's office. So I just reached out to Frank directly because I know that he posts on LinkedIn, he posts little comments and things from his office and things constantly. He's up there. As a matter of fact, when I looked, he'd been on his LinkedIn account within that last hour. And it posted something that day. So I went ahead and I sent him a question. I said, Secretary LaRose, quick question for you. Given the fact that your instructions are silent to the matter, and given the fact that you are asking for a date of election on this envelope, would the Secretary of State's office, determine that if someone puts a date of April the 28th, which is the day the legislature has announced, and they're going out there saying, you got to get it all in by April 28th, because that's the last day you can cast the ballot. Well, if that's the last day you can cast the ballot, that's the election day, Chuck. Or is there potential it could be invalidated if somebody now sends it in with postmarked in April with a March 17th date on that envelope? Are they going to be counted or not? Well, Chuck, let's see, that was on, this is Thursday, that was on Monday night. I haven't heard anything back from the Secretary of State.
It's static,
except now today in the Associated Press, yesterday, this was on Wednesday, The Associated Press ran with a headline, Ohio Elections Chief, yeah, that's Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, Ohio Elections Chief says no major problems yet in odd vote. So, I know that he's seen it. I know that I put the question out there clearly to him that, hey, what happens if you have ballots that come in that are dated the 17th but postmarked late, or you have ballots that are that are written in for April the 28th for an election that the primary is actually March the 17th? How's that going to happen? And the question is, or the I guess the request is, would the Secretary of State, is he going to, or has he, because I haven't seen yet that he has yet, has he issued directives to the county boards of elections to make sure that you don't have any funny business, and that because of this odd election, as the AP puts it, odd vote, that we don't end up with more major problems by making sure that when people send their ballots in this absentee world now, this vote-by-mail world we have at the moment, that they actually get counted, Chuck. I think it's going to be... And then you, in the meantime, were saying you were going to check into something, and what did you find?
Well, I asked some... it came up in a discussion during a prayer meeting, believe it or not. And I asked people about whether they'd filled one out yet, and somebody said yes. I said, how long ago did you get it? And she said, oh, I've had mine for a couple of weeks. Well, I've only had mine for about a week, maybe. And she said directly, she said in the instructions, and I, in the instructions that she got on the yellow sheet, it said put the date March 17th.
Well, see, that's very interesting because as I told you, and I had my ballot instructions here, it had nowhere on there that said to put March 17th as the date.
Mine doesn't either. Mine says nothing.
It says, I don't know exactly. So if this is a question, is there a, you know, is that in your county? Are some people at the Board of Elections telling people to do something specific that may or may not invalidate their ballot?
Well, that instruction.
Or at the very least, cause it to be set aside and marked as a provisional ballot, because you can only really vote provisional ballots in person. So that's going to be a question mark as to whether or not these ballots are going to get counted or not, or if there's going to be a situation where it gets sorted. Now, again, on that envelope, if you haven't requested. You're going to hear this on Saturday. If you haven't requested your ballot for this election, well, you're not going to get it.
No, it's too late.
You have to go in and vote provisional, which means you're going to have to contact your Board of Elections on Monday to find out if they're going to be available so you can walk in on Tuesday and vote.
My guess is no.
Okay. You've got this whole situation that, you know, if you haven't... if you've requested and you've gotten that absentee ballot, and maybe you still haven't turned it in yet, or you're thinking about, or you're filling it out, but you haven't gotten it in, if you look on that envelope, Chuck, that information envelope that you have to put the ballot in to seal it to before you send it in, it also requires that after you put the date of that election, that you mark that it's for a primary. There's a difference between, there's a general primary and special. There's three different little check boxes. And of course, this is a primary election, so you're supposed to mark primary. But then there's another thing that you're supposed to mark that you're asking for, whether you're asking for a partisan ballot or a issues-only ballot. Now, of course, we know in primaries, it's for the parties to determine who their standard bearers are for the general election. So if you are a Republican, you would be voting, presumably, a Republican ballot. If you're a Democrat, you're asking for a Democrat ballot because those are your candidates that you're helping to choose who is going to be on the general ballot. So that's what those are for. Or if you don't consider yourself aligned with the Republicans or the Democrats, you can ask for a ballot and you just vote on issues, which are your tax levies and things of that nature. You just don't vote for partisan positions. Well, if you mark that you're asking for a partisan ballot, you have to write in on a line at the end which party.
Yeah, you have to write that in.
Of course, I wrote in Republican and other people write in Democrat. Well, you know, Chuck, there's this outside possibility as well, because the county boards of elections are made up of two Republicans and two Democrats. So they're very partisan, that, you know, you can have a situation where in some counties, these ballots come in, they see these absentee ballots, they've got a date on them that is either the date that's long since passed, March 17th, like your one friend, or they have a date on them that is coming up, April the 28th, and they go down there and they see, well, okay, this is a Republican ballot, and I'm a Democrat, and I'm going to mark this as provisional because I'm interpreting the rule that if they mark the primary and they put the date April 28th, well, that really isn't the primary. The primary was March 17th, so there's a question about this ballot. Let's set it to the side. Or vice versa, you know, I'm a Republican and it's marked Democrat, and they've got March 17th down. Well, that date's already passed. Let's set that to the side.
Yep.
You can see where this can be gamed, Chuck.
Oh, very easily gamed.
There's an awful lot of question mark arising. So, let's just not kid ourselves. Supposedly, we're going to finish out the 2020 primary election April 28th instead of March 17th when it was supposed to be. But even then, Chuck, when you get it postmarked by the 27th, there is a 10-day window after April the 28th in order for all of those ballots that were sent in by mail, maybe on Monday, to reach the county boards of elections. So you're looking at, okay, so April 28th, there's 30 days in April. So you're looking at March the 8th is actually the total cutoff for the county boards of elections to receive the ballots. Once they receive all the ballots, Chuck, then they have to do the count. You know, they have to actually tally those cast votes. And then they have to certify the election to the Secretary. So they have to certify their county results to the Secretary of State's office, who then certifies the election. Well, that process usually takes 2 or more weeks, Chuck. And what's usually the case is during an election day, you have media and others who are standing outside polling places, and they're running and they're kind of doing the polling, trying to figure out the post-cast polling to determine, and based on early returns from some of the counties, because they'll report so much coming in at a time. You know, we all have been up on election night watching these numbers roll in. They can presume who's going to win these primaries. Chuck, there won't be any of that happening, because it's all going to be on paper. It's all going to be sitting in the hands of a board of elections and their officials, who are going to be sitting there determining, A, if the ballot was cast correctly or not with that election date question, B, separating them by Republican and Democrat, and C, then having to go through and count and make sure that, okay, all right, let me understand the will of the voter here, because I'm not sure when they put this circle here and it drifted a little, did they mean to mark this or did they mean to mark that? You can see where this is going.
Oh, yeah, it's so easy, so easy.
But liberal progressives in the Democrat Party, Nancy Pelosi and others, are clamoring right now that because we're having this experience in many states, except for Wisconsin, who obviously got theirs done, and the world didn't end with them actually holding an actual primary election with people walking into polling places. The Democrats and the progressive left are trying to get us to convince that this is the way we should do all elections, Chuck, that it should be mail only, that we should get rid of that archaic model of having people, you know, opening polls and having polling places in schools and churches, especially churches. We can't have them in churches. That's a separation of church and state issue. but they're wanting to go to a complete mail-in ballot, Chuck. We've just seen right now when Ohio had to do it, and even the Secretary of State is filing special provisions. You and I both noticed the date on the instruction sheet was April of this year. What was the date on that information envelope you had to put your ballot in?
Oh, gosh, 2017?
September of 2017 was the last time that envelope had been updated. Why? Because when the legislature moved everything, they didn't change the regulations or the statutes around the Secretary of State's office for them to update that envelope information. But it would have been fine had it been a normal, okay, the legislature's picked this date for the election to take place, and you're trying to get, you know, you can't make it that day, so you're filling out an absentee ballot, and you're going to write that day in. Well, we got two different days now, Chuck. We had the 17th of March, and now we have the 28th of April. 5 weeks apart. Okay, folks, if this election turns out to be something that you're just, you know, it's confusing, you're not alone. And I believe that it won't be over with for a while, Chuck, because I believe we're probably going to end up with lawsuits from candidates who feel that they got shafted because of the potential shenanigans around this mail-in vote. So you may end up in some instances, in some sort, and I know you've got a hot one in your backyard.
Oh, yeah.
And there are some hot ones around the state of the highly contested races where tons of money have been spent on both sides, and barbs have flown back and forth, and accusations and challenges and elections commissions complaints, blah, blah, blah. You know there are going to be lawsuits, no matter who comes out supposedly the winner by the count, to go back and micro-examine these ballots. Well, Chuck, if it continues on that many of these are, there's no confidence in the outcome of these elections, what do you suppose would probably are going to happen that one or the other groups are going to do? But they're going to ask a judge to step in, invalidate the results of these primaries, and set a new date for a primary election that is a actual physical walk-in election where everybody has to go back in and cast their ballots. I can see it coming.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, this is a mess. This is a mess in the making. And just to add insult to injury, I dug up an article out of the Daily Signal. And yes, they basically listed 15 election results that were thrown out because of fraudulent mail-in ballots.
Yes.
15. That doesn't sound like much. And let's not go to Stacey Abrams, who basically said, who on one hand is jumping up and down screaming about voter suppression, and on the other hand saying ballot fraud, election fraud is mostly non-existent. Well, Barry, isn't voter suppression a form of election fraud?
Yes, it is.
So now people are saying, well, there is a distinction. No, not really. There isn't. There is no distinction. They're the same thing. Okay, so having made that editorial comment, let's look at some of these. Essentially, the federal government, or at least some elements of the federal government, are working to force the use of mail-in ballots. Not far behind that will be online voting, which everybody knows will be so fraud-laced as to be almost a laughable example, something we would actually laugh about if it weren't so tragic. But the fact is, in one of the most high-profile cases, the North Carolina Board of Elections decertified the outcome of the 2018 race in the 9th Congressional District. Do you remember why they do you remember that particular thing in 2018, Barry?
Off the top of my head, no.
Okay. 61% of all mailed votes were cast for Republican candidate Mark Harris over Democrat Dan McCready. If you remember, Harris was forced out of the seat, even though he won it. Only 16% of those requesting a ballot were Republicans. In the new election, Republican Dan Bishop stepped in as the party nominee and won. Now, what happened there was he was accused, the Republican candidate, Mark Harris, was accused of doing what? Do you remember this at all? Obviously, you said you didn't.
No, I don't, yeah.
Ballot harvesting.
Oh!
He was ballot harvesting.
Explain ballot harvesting
okay.
to our listeners.
Ballot harvesting is essentially going to people who have getting people to apply for absentee ballots and then going in and helping them fill them out and then collecting them and bringing them to the Board of Elections yourself. Or, you know, you have a campaign.
Isn't that just democracy in action, Chuck?
No, it's not, because what happens is, in places like North Carolina, that is explicitly forbidden. In California, it's legal. And there have been people, lots and lots and lots of Republicans who have been knocked out of office over this practice. Because what's happening is, essentially, Democratic activists are going in and applying for getting people to apply for absentee ballots who really have no business voting. They're senile, they're mentally incompetent, and that kind of thing. And then they're going around and collecting the ballots and turning them in. And if they get a Republican ballot, they won't take it. In other words, it's a partisan way of making sure that only your candidate's ballots are counted and not the other person's ballots. Because the way this works is if a Democratic Party activist goes out to harvest the ballot and the person has filled out a Republican ballot, they won't take it, leaving this person who may not have been real keen on voting in the first place with no real recourse. They don't really know how the system works, and it really is open fraud.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Now, they didn't mention that in the story, but I remember this case. They actually threw out the Republican who did this ballot harvesting over the fact that he'd done ballot harvesting. And let me tell you, liberals were all like, yay, we got one of these guys. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in the same case, in California and other states in the West, in liberal states, they're doing exactly the same thing. Well, that's a good thing out there. Okay. That's the kind of fraudulent behavior we can expect to see, ballot harvesting. I don't know what the law is in Ohio. I'll be quite honest. I don't know. Wouldn't shock me to find out that it was illegal here, but it also wouldn't shock me to find out that the law doesn't speak to it because apparently this is a relatively new thing that somebody thought of.
And it seems like a lot of the progressive left are jumping onto this idea.
Bingo. All right. So if you want your election stolen and Ohio election law doesn't say anything, guess what? You're going to get it.
Absolutely.
Let's see. In 2018, Dennis Jones beat Tracy Gray by one vote in a Republican primary in Texas for a seat on the Kaufman County Commissioner's Court. Gray challenged the outcome, alleging a vote harvester submitted illegal mail-in ballots while eligible provisional ballots went uncounted. After a hearing, a state judge invalidated the results and ordered a new election, which Gray won by 404 votes. Again, Barry, what's the magic word? Ballot harvester.
Ballot harvester, yeah.
And you've got a winner by one vote, and they didn't count the provisionals?
Oops. That sounds to me like that's a little questionable.
That deck was stacked. Seriously stacked. Mm-hmm. And which is why the judge threw it out. In another 2018 Texas case, Armando Ocana seemingly won a runoff race for mayor in Mission, Texas, beating incumbent Norberto Beto Salinas. But after strong evidence emerged that Ocana's campaign had bribed voters, tampered with absentee ballots, which can happen in a harvested ballot, and improperly assisted voters at the polls, State Judge Jay Bonner Dorsey invalidated the result, saying, I hold or find by clear and convincing evidence that the number of illegal votes was in excess of 158. Okay?
Okay.
This is the kind of thing we can expect to see. I'm sorry to tell you this. In 2017, Eatonville, Florida, Mayor Anthony Grant was convicted of a felony charge of voting fraud and misdemeanor absentee voting violations. Prosecutors said that as a candidate in 2015, Grant coerced absentee voters to cast ballots for him. In at least one case, prosecutors said Grant personally solicited an absentee vote from a non-resident. Grant, a former mayor, lost the in-person vote but won the election with more than twice the number of absentee ballots that incumbent Bruce Mount got. After Grant's indictment, then Governor Rick Scott suspended the mayor. After his conviction, he was sentenced to 400 hours of community service and 4 years probation, which is essentially a slap on the wrist.
Ain't democracy grand.
Ain't it beautiful. The case was more than a decade after the Florida Department of Law Enforcement concluded, quote, the absentee ballot is the tool of choice for those who are engaging in election fraud, end quote. And they're correct.
Yes, they are.
If you want to defraud the system, have it all be by absentee ballot. Now, we've had people for years who were screaming for paper ballots. You remember that? Everybody wanted, no more electronic voting, they wanted paper ballots.
Yep.
And I always said, you can just as easily steal paper vote as you can an electronic vote. It'd be a piece of cake. You just mar the ballot. Nope, can't count it. The whole hanging Chad thing, you remember that mess in 2000?
I do.
that mess, you know, I had voted that way with the punch key for years. Years and years and years and years. And all of a sudden, it's a problem in four Florida counties in 2000. Yeah, I don't think so. In 2017, an Alabama state judge, I'm not going to read all of them, but in 2017, an Alabama state judge reversed the result of a race for Wetumpka City Council in which incumbent Percy Gill appeared to have won by 3 votes. Gill's opponent, Lewis Washington, contested the outcome. A trial showed 8 absentee ballots cast for Gill either had a forged signature or weren't notarized or signed in front of the requisite number of witnesses. In Ohio, you don't even have to do that.
No, you don't.
You just sign it and turn it in. Well, unless someone signs it for you. And this was a problem in years past. I can remember, Barry, getting, I'm trying to remember what election it was, where the Secretary of State was automatically sending out absentee applications. It may have been the County Board of Elections. You didn't even have to apply for it. They just sent it to you. Here's your application.
Oh, well, it's John Houston, when he was Secretary of State, did that. They sent out absentee applications to every registered voter.
Yeah, and I'm like, this is an invitation to fraud.
And I think that was in 2016, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Yes, it was.
It was an absolute invitation to fraud.
Yes, indeed.
Look, in 2016, race for mayor of Gordon, Alabama, Albert Melton won by just 16 votes. Melton later was convicted on 2 counts of absentee ballot fraud and removed from office. He was sentenced to a year in prison and 2 years probation. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. It's not just in the South. It's not just in Texas. There's one in New York State. Guilty 1 count of criminal possession of forged instruments during his 2014 campaign. Pennsylvania. Former police chief pleaded guilty to soliciting absentee ballots to benefit his wife and her running mate in the 2009 Democratic primary for town council. Tony applied for ballots, then had them filled out illegally by individuals who were not expected to be absent on election day. In other words, there were people who, I do recall this, there were people who showed up to vote. Oh, you already voted absentee. I did no such thing.
Right.
They were allowed to vote provisionally in most cases.
Well, yes, and that's usually the way it would work, too. So,
right. And I did not vote.
Whether those votes ever got counted or not.
That's the question.
Whether the original, quote-unquote, you already voted when they didn't got counted or not, that's another question.
Remember, provisionals are almost always never counted unless it's a really close election.
True.
Let's see. West Virginia. Mississippi, all over the place. These are not isolated incidents. These are just the ones they put together for this particular article. Alabama,
well, yeah.
East Chicago, Indiana, which I know where that is. It's right there just across the border from Illinois. I used to work up there. Yeah, all of a sudden, here's the case. In 2003, a mayor's race in East Chicago, Indiana, challenger George Pabe defeated 8-term incumbent Robert Patrick on Election Day, but lost by 278 votes after about 2,000 absentee ballots poured in.
Oh, my.
Yes.
That's quite a few.
Okay, this is why we are...
Wasn't there a thing with Al Franken finding ballots in the trunk
gosh.
Of a car?
Al Franken, it was he defeated Norm Coleman on the strength of some ballots that were discovered, quote unquote, discovered in the back boot, the trunk of 2 different vehicles. So, yeah, in clear plastic bags, just in the back of a vehicle. Hey, here's some ballots we have to count. I mean, so again, that's the to the people I say who told me that paper ballots would be the panacea. Not so much. But evidence of voter intimidation and vote buying emerged, and the Indiana Supreme Court ordered a new election. Pabee won with 65% of the vote. So he's the challenger, as detailed in the 2000 book, Stealing Elections. Fraud has led to at least 7 convictions or guilty pleas in 2008. That's from a Heritage database, the Heritage, which I think is the Heritage Foundation. Stacey Abrams jumping up and down and saying that voter fraud is essentially a non-starter. She's just flat out wrong. Just flat out. We have a real.
She's flat out wrong about a lot of things. That's just one of them.
Which is why she's a leading candidate for vice president with Joe Biden. If he actually makes it as far as the convention, you can poo poo it or not. Barry and I have been poo pooing each other's. Barry's theory about Michelle Obama is looking better and better all the time.
I appreciate you saying so.
Yeah, it's becoming a real possibility. I really think what's going to happen is, though, that Joe Biden's going to break down sometime between now and the convention, because the convention is now pushed back to August, and there's an interview with Joe Biden and Al Gore together, and Biden just sort of like loses track of what he's talking about, and you can see it on Al Gore's face. His eyebrows just sort of go up. He's like, how do I handle this?
Where was I?
What do I do now?
Where was I?
Yeah, what do I do now? So I would look to someone like them saying, this won't work. Of course, they won't go to Bernie because they know that's a guaranteed election loser. I could really see a draft Cuomo movement. I mean, it's already, the rumblings are out there. He says, I won't take the job. I don't believe that. I don't believe that for a minute, the way he's immediately turned on President Trump after praising him. The fact is that this is in flux, and folks, do not sit by when it is proposed that we not have a walk-in election in the fall. Because
there will be so many people, Chuck. I mean, I'm watching it now on a certain other piece, which I don't think we're going to have time to get to.
Right.
But, you know, people are overreacting on somebody's comments. You know that it's so easy, especially for someone in a position of authority, like, say, a director of Department of Health or a secretary of state or maybe even a governor, when they come out and raise these serious doubts about the ability for us to keep you safe when you to go to the polling places, you're going to have the lemmings and the spineless jellyfish,
yeah,
who are going to be like, oh, please protect us, governor, please protect us, yeah, you leaders, help us to you know, do whatever basically is going to be in our worst interest.
Well, and there will be people that will surprise you. I'm already surprised by some people I know who are in an absolute panic over this thing and calling us conspiracy theorists because we're actually dealing with the science of this thing and saying the numbers don't meet the criteria. The numbers don't match anything, and even ginning up and fudging the numbers doesn't make it even come close. Is it dangerous out there for certain people? Yes, it is. Is it dangerous for most of us? No, it's not. In fact, we're probably going to have to do what California has already done, and they did a countywide. They did a countywide Los Angeles County study, and what they discovered was that there were somewhere between somewhere under 500,000 and somewhere or between under 500,000 or over 750,000. So between 500,000 and 750,000 people who have been exposed, most of whom had no symptoms whatsoever or recovered quickly from common cold or minor flu-like symptoms. And this is in one county in California. And I forget how many deaths they've had out there, but it's exceedingly low. The death count was somewhere in the vicinity of 0.03%, which is under the number that I said it was going to turn out to be.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like, "Are you sure? Are you sure?" Yes. And because
that's even with us like trying to pad the numbers by putting in the quote unquote suspected cases.
Yes, that's right. Well, I just saw one. First corona death was not attributed to the virus originally, and they went back. A woman had a heart attack, and they went back months later and reattributed it to COVID-19 because they did an autopsy and she was positive. And I'm like, oh wait. Now, I will concede at this point that an article I read, oh gosh, about a month ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, and I talked about it a little bit on, was saying that the COVID-19 virus attaches itself to red blood cells. And people were saying, no, it doesn't do that. I said, that's why the oxygen levels go down in COVID-19 patients. And one of the symptoms that people were talking about that comes up from this is their fingertips and their toes get purple.
Yep.
From low oxygenation. So what's happening is actually people in their 30s and 40s that are quote unquote supposedly healthy that actually have circulatory issues they don't know about yet are getting this thing and having severe trouble and sometimes dying because they're getting blood clots. Well, why would you get blood clots from a disease that favors the lungs? You don't. You get blood clots because they're sticking to the red blood cells, and then those red blood cells are sticking together. Okay? There was an actor, a Broadway actor, who, young, in his 30s or 40s, just had to have a leg removed from coronavirus. And at first I was skeptical, and then I'm like, it's that article. If the things are attaching to red blood cells, then they can cause blood clots. And that's exactly what happened to this guy. So nobody's talking about this blood clot thing, and other issues having to do with COVID-19. This is why some seemingly healthy people, a very small number, again, an incredibly tiny number, as we discover how many people have been exposed and have the antibodies, and then suddenly we compare it to how many people have died, the number gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, the total numbers, it's not good for the 65,000 people who are projected to be dead by this thing.
Right.
But that's eight times under what they originally predicted. 65,000, you multiply that by 8, you were at 400,000, which was the bottom line number they were talking about. Now they're talking about 65,000. Barry, the CDC and the IMH have already lowered, the CDC is basically dropping all talk of a resurgence of this in the fall.
Well, that's because they first came out, the media came out and said, oh, the CDC director said that this is coming back in the fall and it's going to be twice as bad.
Yeah.
Or words to that effect.
Well, they have to do that, and there's a reason for that. What they're doing is destroying the credibility of the models completely. And folks, let me tell you something. There's one reason why you're seeing some of the activists out there saying we have to count COVID-19 as a global warming issue. Well, why is that? Because everybody...
Because they're losing steam on the global warming arguments?
There's a reason for that.
Not focusing on that?
but why? And there's a good reason for it. The good reason is people are looking at the models being used to make the predictions for COVID-19. So isn't this the same kind of math that's been used to create the models that global warming panic is based on? And the answer is yes. And the problem with both is the same. It's the assumptions are all bad. The basic assumptions are all bad. When you put garbage in, you get garbage out. If you'll recall, the North Pole was supposed to be melted already. Well, not only did it not melt, it got bigger. Yeah, have we gone through some global warming? Yes, we have. Did we go through some COVID-19 deaths? Yes, we have. Was it anywhere near as bad as they said it was going to be? Of course not. Nowhere near. Well, Barry, with that, we are out of time.
Of course we are.
Of course we are. We didn't even get to one of the issues we wanted to talk about, but we have time next week. So, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And please join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.